مصر قالت صوت ولادي كلمة الحق في بلادي.
هم دول سر التحدي، هم دول زهرة جهادي، هم دول هم الشباب.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters and this is Background Briefing, and let's now get another analysis on the situation in Libya. Joining me from Cairo is Mohamed Bamyeh. Mohamed Bamyeh is professor of sociology at the University of Pittsburgh. His books include The End of Globalization, Drugs in Motion, Mind and Body Altering Substances in the World's Cultural Economy, and Anarchy as Order, The History and Future of Civic Humanity. He has a forthcoming book called Intellectuals and Civil Society in the Middle East. The Islamic intellectual site mufta.org recently published his essay, Is the 2011 Libyan Revolution an Exception? In your article, Mohamed Bamyeh, you do suggest that the ending may be somewhat similar to the Romanian president, Nicolae Ceausescu. So do you expect Gaddafi to be put up against a wall and shot, or will he flee to Chad and live out his exile in some sub-Saharan country?
If he's caught, I'm sure he will be put to trial. That is what the Provisional National Council is saying. They want to put him on trial. But who knows? I think it is likely that he will try to escape to the south, at least, or to somewhere else. In Chad, indeed, that's one of the possibilities, and try to orchestrate some kind of trouble. I'm not sure exactly how or what are the real basis for doing that. But he's not the kind of person who is going to surrender. He knows that it is over for him. Yeah, and also, it is too late for him to be admitted into any country. There were, in the last few weeks, there were some offers that he could go, for example, to certain countries. Venezuela was mentioned, Turkey, the United Arab Emirates, but it's unlikely that any of those countries would want him now. So his options are becoming more and more limited, and that is why I expect that his end is going to be gloomy.
Again, I'm speaking with Mohamed Bamyeh, who's in Cairo, and you mentioned a second ago that you didn't think that the opposition forces, the so-called rebels, they want to put Gaddafi on trial, not execute him. And you make a distinction here, saying that they already are showing signs of a new civic ethic, whereas Gaddafi's forces slaughter captured opposition members, the revolutionary camp holds its captives as prisoners of war. So there's already evidence of an ethic amongst these the opposition, but here in the Western press, they still appear to be a mystery, who they are and what their composition is.
Yes, I mean, the mystery is because all the revolutions are now a mystery. And that there's a reason for that, because they're not being organized by any established political party or any discernible organization. And they don't have any recognizable leadership, even though in Libya now you do have some kind of leadership, but it is very fluid. And the reason for that is that these are truly popular revolutions, in the sense that they have a spontaneous character. They first erupt, and then organization and leadership come later after the revolution is in motion. And this is really a rare phenomenon in history. But that is really the pattern that we see all over this region right now. And the rebels are everyone. They are members of all classes of Libyan society. They are lawyers. They are workers. They are members of tribes. They don't really have any single political ideology. So in other words, they're not socialist or Islamist or what have you. But their demands are similar in a general sense to the demands that were raised in Libya, in Egypt, in Tunisia, and now in Yemen, and in Bahrain as well, in Syria as well, which is the establishment of democratic governing structures, the building of modern civic states, more civic liberties, and so on. So by and large, all these revolutions can be called liberal revolutions, in the sense. And the reason for that is sociological, I think, at the root of it, namely that in the past two or three decades, Arab societies in general have become far more modern than their governments, whereas the governments are continuing to run as basically as closed societies, basically with unquestioned leadership style and a dictatorial style as well. Society below them is becoming more and more modern, where youth cultures are vibrant, are strong, where society is connected to all kinds of modern communication technology, where education rates are also higher among men as well as among women, and so on. So that is the reality that is happening. All these forces, all these modernizing forces in the society are rising now and demanding a new type of state. And you see that in Libya as well. So it is, in a nutshell, if you want to call it, it is the civic culture of the country. That is the revolution. That is what it is. People are, it's not the political party in particular. It is not any coherent organization. It is the sum total of all civic participatory traditions that are making the revolution. And that is what it is.
And of course, somewhat predictably, we're focused on evidence of al-Qaeda, which of course is what Gaddafi has been trying to say all along. And even the one of the top NATO military leaders the other day said, well, there are flickers of al-Qaeda amongst the opposition. But I think it's obviously been always exaggerated. But you're arguing that the tribalism has been overemphasized and that Gaddafi's state is not a tribal state so much as a mafia state.
Sure, exactly. Exactly. And I did look at that very carefully, and I had been looking at tribal declarations and declarations issued the names of tribes, and also how tribes basically are addressed by the provisional government vis-a-vis how tribal discourse is used by the Gaddafi government. And tribes are not homogeneous entities. In other words, they don't really have executive councils. They don't move together. They live throughout Libya in particular, and most of Libyan society is urban. Lives in major cities. About 88% of Libyan society lives, in fact, in urban areas. And the large urban areas include within them almost all members of all tribes in Libya that are intermarried. So it is a very mixed type of society, even though there are tribal loyalties, but they're not only loyalties that you have, and they're not unconditional. So it is not uncommon that you would see pro-Qaddafi and anti-Qaddafi elements within the same tribe. That is not uncommon. That happens, in fact. But it is not tribal. It cannot be described as a tribal society, even though, of course, a tribe, just as in Yemen, is part of the culture. But it is not the only kind of thing that people have loyalty to, and it is not an unconditional type of loyalty.
This fluid mix of tribal networks, Sufi orders, and coastal communities that you speak of does appear to be what we see on television. And what particularly strikes me as quite extraordinary, you know, we've talked about, particularly on the left, we've talked about people's revolution, people power, the Sandinistas, etc. But these people who are taking up arms and literally wearing jeans and T-shirts as if they've just left their homes and gone to the front carrying a rusty old rifle, if anything exemplifies a people's army, they do.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, they do. These are old local traditions modernized, of course, but this is like the people who are used to self-governance, and now they have a sense of collective national dignity. That is a moral outrage at the excesses of the regime, its willingness to threaten its people with genocide, which it was doing, in fact. And there are there is a great deal of confidence that you see among those people. That's also, I saw that in Cairo as well as in Tunisia, in the sense that all these revolutions that we see around, and here in Libya is less of an exception, the participants, those people's armies, if you will, as well as people on the street in general, who are part of these revolutions, seem to exude an incredible level of confidence that I haven't actually seen before, that they are right, that the cause is right and just. There's a willingness to sacrifice and a martyr, and be a martyr without that much use of religious discourse. So it is just moral outrage in a modern way against the excesses and inappropriateness of the style of government that they have. That is expressed in an almost secular, kind of, a secular kind of grievance. And that is what we seem to be witnessing here. Now, the regimes themselves don't know how to respond so far to all these revolutions, and on all of them, they really respond in the same way, which is to try to point to effect that doesn't exist. The Qaeda is here, for example, or if we leave, fundamentalist forces are going to take over, and so on. So part of what the government in charge are doing, or were doing in the face of these revolutions, is to exaggerate the danger of chaos, the danger of extremism, the danger of fundamentalism if they were to be overthrown, and thereby to reduce whatever support that exists outside their countries for the revolutions. That is really the standard response, and it is not credible. Because Al-Qaeda is not there. Al-Qaeda doesn't know what to do with what is happening now. Even Islam itself is not being used as a language of resistance throughout any of these revolutions. None of these revolutions are about Islam. None of them are about reintroducing the Sharia, but they are about introducing a new, modern, democratic civic state throughout this region.
Well, again, I'm speaking with sociologist Mohamed Bamyeh, who is in Cairo. So there is, of course, criticism of NATO's intervention throughout the Middle East, starting with Turkey. I imagine there's some of it there in Egypt. But why is it that the president, in his speech last night, did say that it is a national security issue to defend the Libyan rebels, if you will, from being exterminated? That in turn would have created a refugee problem in both Egypt and Tunisia and affected these fragile new governments in transition. Why is it, though, that the Egyptian military, who are in control of Egypt at the moment, why aren't they helping out their brothers in next door in Libya?
Yeah, well, the Egyptian arm, the Egyptian state, supported the no-fly zone and called on the UN to pass a resolution to that effect, and is supporting at least politically at what the United States, France, and Britain are doing, and Qatar right now, of course, are doing in Libya. But the Egypt just emerged out of the revolution itself. The Egyptian army is too distracted. It is still in the streets of Cairo and the main cities. It is not on the front line. It is bogged down with the business of running the country. There is still a question of transition into writing a new constitution, electing a new parliament. That could happen probably 6 months from now, a new president eventually. All kinds of many revolutions that are happening in Egypt still, the aspects of the revolution, such as strikes, demands for the removal of corrupt officials left over from the old regime here. All that is still happening in Egypt. So Egypt is too, there's too much distraction happening right now and too much need for the army to focus all its energies on running Egypt itself. So that is, and also the rebels, the thing that the rebels would need, I think, more than anything else now, because I think that this war will have to be managed ultimately by Libyans themselves, not by the outside world, but they need to be armed better. They need to be also supported politically more, in the sense that this provisional government needs to be acknowledged as the legitimate voice of the Libyan people. Part of the strategy, the American position that I don't understand is if you say that you can't live with Gaddafi anymore and that he is illegitimate, why not simply go one step further and recognize the opposition government as the legitimate government and work with it and also have your allies do the same thing, just like as France did. So I think there are many, even though Egypt itself is unable right now to be involved directly, but it has been supporting in a humanitarian way, the borders are open with Libya. All kinds of supplies, medicines, food, and so on come through the border. So that helps.
Just in closing, Mohamed Bamier, just to touch on what's happening in Egypt, where you are, it seems to me that there have been reports that the Muslim Brotherhood, who played a sort of backseat role in the non-violent revolution that was largely propelled by young, urban, educated Egyptians, there are reports that they are making a comeback and that they've always sort of been the power behind the scenes and that they've made some kind of deal with the army and that in future power shuffles, they will end up the kingmakers along with the army. Is that the possible outcome?
Now, I think the Muslim Brotherhood is a significant political force in the country, and it will remain so. And in a democratic society, as the attempt now is being made in Egypt, if all significant political forces are represented, then, of course, they are going to be represented and they are going to have a role. But I don't think there has been any deal that was made so far. They did support the referendum that happened last about a week and a half ago, to pass amendments to the Constitution so that we can move to the next stage of the transition. Other, of course, parts of the revolution opposed it. But they themselves are splintering like one would expect, because one thing that may happen, I think, is that the Muslim Brotherhood themselves may generate probably three different political parties. Right? One has already been formed, sort of a left Islamic party that came out of the Brotherhood. The organization wants to form its own official kind of political party, which is sort of centrist Islamic party. There's another wing of it that wants to form a third Islamic party that comes out of the Brotherhood and so on. So itself, the Brotherhood itself may become several parties at the end of this game, because it is itself a diverse group of individuals that was kept together because in the past they were repressed together, and therefore there was a lot of incentive to stick together. Also, under the dictatorship of Mubarak, when there were no options available, when there was no foreseeable transition into any kind of other form of governance, political Islam did not develop ideologically. There were no really new developments on the horizon in terms of Islamic political thinking because nothing depended on it. There was no government and no state that were open to an Islamic takeover, certainly not in Egypt. Now that has changed because when you run an active political Islamic party, and you run for elections, you actually do have to present a viable platform that is persuasive. You have to receive criticism in the public sphere. You have to defend your position. You have to say something more than Islam is the solution. You have to be specific about how you're able to solve people's problems. So what is going to happen, and that is, I think, is more the more interesting question than whether the Muslim Brotherhood will take over or not, is what is going to happen to their thought, how it is going to develop further beyond that point. And it is developing, it is becoming a little bit more complex. The Turkish model is often being cited as the way to go, because in Turkey now you do have a successful example of sort of conservative, traditional counter-Islamic party coming to power, and in fact, not imposing the Sharia, but rather running a modern, non-corrupt state very highly and very successfully. So well, that is the model that is being talked about here as one of the pathways that political Islam in this country may take.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today from Cairo, Mohamed Bamier. Again, I've been speaking with Mohamed Bamier, who is a professor of sociology at the University of Pittsburgh. His books include Drugs in Motion, Mind and Body, Altering Substances in the World's Cultural Economy, Anarchy as Order, The History and Future of Civic Humanity, and his forthcoming book, Intellectuals and Civil Society in the Middle East. Let's now take a brief station break, and we're back talking with Chris Hedges.
Thank you.